This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A candle lights the darkness, then burns out. Is that the fate of the human species? As the pandemic rages, where are we now in the climate crisis? Dr. Andrew Glickson is an earth and paleoclimate scientist with the Climate Science Institute at Australian National University. He has published almost 150 scientific papers and articles that I know of, and several books. Every couple of years, we check in with Andrew on Radio EcoShock. His latest book from Springer Press is The Event Horizon, Homo Prometheus and the Climate Catastrophe. From Canberra, Australia, Andrew Glickson, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alex. It's good to hear you.
These are horrible times. For most people in the Northern Hemisphere, this pandemic, it feels like a long jail sentence with few visitors allowed. How are you holding up, Andrew?
Yes, the pandemic is a horrible, horrible thing for about hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. In perspective, pandemics have always occurred in human history, especially the history of civilization. It's only that, well, perhaps psychologically, we're not prepared for it. But three of my grandparents have died in the great flu epidemic. So it's in part a question of memory, collective memory. Yes, the pandemic is awful. Australia is doing particularly well. Yes, it's a very well-organized society. I am, well, at my stage of life, I suppose I'm somewhat vulnerable with my diabetes, but other than that, so far, I'm well. Thank you for asking.
Well, let's see if we can escape into deep time, and you're a specialist in chronicling that. When were the fastest rates of global warming that scientists can find, and do any compare to our current rate of heating the world?
None compares to what's happening now. They're all the ones which occur at the end of the ice ages. They are at least an order of magnitude slower, lesser than what's happening now. Of course, as you know, what's happening now is happening within one generation.
Well, during the last few million years, changes in the Earth's orbit, we know the way we orbit around the sun triggered a back and forth of ice ages and warm periods. And by that measure, I've recently read, Earth should have returned to cooling and to more glaciers somewhere around 5,000 years ago when the Egyptians were building pyramids. Is there new science to explain why that did not happen?
Right through the period of the Holocene, which is from about 10,000 years ago to the present, there have been intermittent, gradual cooling, but nothing major, but the sign now it has been approaching or moving towards the next ice age. This shows very well in the charts. When you look at the charts from the Holocene peak at about 9,000 and 8,000, until the Industrial Revolution, there are a lot of ups and downs, but on average, there has been a gradual cooling by somewhat less than 1 degree. But, of course, everything has changed. During the Holocene, civilization already started to release carbon dioxide and methane from agriculture and burning of the forests. So this cooling was mitigated by human activity, but not enough to conceal this otherwise overall cooling trajectory.
And as you develop this big picture for humanity, you spend a chapter in your new book on human origins. What was our birth environment like? What are we built for?
All right, these were the ice ages, the glacial, interglacial ages, and the human existence was precarious. The conditions, there were only relatively small human clans. Many of them were in the subtropics in Africa, where they were shielded from the ice ages or the worst of the ice ages. Humans had to migrate due to changes in the climate and extreme weather events from Africa to part of Asia and eventually Europe. Human existence was precarious right through the glacial interglacial period, at least until they adopted or mastered fire. Fire allowed humans to survive and even expand over large parts of the world.
Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I know in other writings you have developed how fire may have helped us with our intelligence, or at least with our minds. Could you just give us a brief shot at that one?
Yeah, thank you. It's partly based on my own life experience around campfires in conducting geological service in Central and Western Australia. Sitting around the fire for hours, many hours, just about every night, for many weeks and many months, has a profound effect on the mindset. And I just inferred from that, I mean, even though I've spent, whatever I've spent, maybe 30 years or so around campfires, I inferred that humans who spent most or all of their lives around campfires, that they were profoundly affected by watching the flames. Flames are alive. They dance, they crackle when humans watch them for hours and hours, every night, well, almost every night. They get affected, and it would trigger and enhance human imagination. It did to me. I started writing poetry around the campfires. So I made some inferences. Of course, these things cannot be proven in a formula or even in a direct experiment. Very difficult. But I had this thought, and this goes further from people who regarded fire as a basis for the appearance of modern humans, who became taller, could run faster. They were able to perspire once the fur has been shed, and they were able to cook meat. Cooking meat made a difference. They started to increase the nutrition from proteins and so on.
We know right as we speak that Greenland is melting a lot. I mean, fresh water is just pouring right off of Greenland. You have written about something called a stadial event. Why are you raising those concerns now? What is a stadial event, and why now?
The observation of stadial events is relatively recent, because it came up from the study of the oceans and from satellites. Initially, south of Greenland, where a large blob of cold water was identified by a number of oceanographers, Ramsholt is from the Potsdam Institute, was the first one who published it, or maybe not the first one, but he wrote a paper in 2015, which is the title is Exceptional Cooling, Exceptional Expansion of Cooling Areas South of Greenland, in North Atlantic. Well, it could be regarded just as accidental or insignificant, but it has been growing. Ocean regions have been going around Antarctica. Again, the flow of ice melt water is clearly the major factor. So my approach didn't start from this modern observation. It started more from paleoclimate. When you look at the glacial interglacial periods, every time when temperatures reach the peak, and that's even in the early Holocene, about, 8,000 years ago, and before then, between 11 and 12,000 years ago, every time temperatures have reached the peak, almost every time without any variation, without any exception, I should say, there was abrupt cooling. And sometimes the cooling was occurred over very short periods. The best known one is called the Younger Dryas, when much of the Earth, but particularly the Northern Hemisphere, cooled for longer than 1,000 years. And it cooled extremely abruptly, and the cooling in the Northern Hemisphere was several degrees. There was also some cooling in the Southern Hemisphere. And this is what's referred to as a stadial, abrupt cooling event for various periods. The most recent one was 8,200 years ago in the Laurentian, closer to your part of the world, when melting of the Laurentian ice sheet resulted in a major flow of ice melt water into North America, forming a large lake called Lake Agassiz. This is very well documented in the paleoclimate record and charts.
So this might be, though, more of a regional event than a global event. Is that correct? Like it might cool Britain and Europe more than they would have been if this happens?
The understudy was a global event, not as strong in the southern hemisphere as in the northern hemisphere, but a global event, and for a long time, longer than 1,000 years. The Laurentian a bit less so than there are all the events in the paleoclimatic record. And the thing is, it's basically the law of physics. When the ice melts sheet, particularly the large ones, Greenland is very large, but Antarctic is huge. When they melt, enough cold water flow into the surrounding oceans to cool at least the upper part of the water column down to a few hundred meters, maybe a kilometer or so, whereas the warm water resulting from global warming at the present time, they all care beneath it, because cold water, as you know, is lighter, less dense. The warm water are salty, so they are more dense.
That's interesting, because, you know, with air, we think of warm air as being lighter than cold air, but it's the reverse with water because of the salt factor. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, yes.
I'm also very interested in what's coming up from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They have a synthesis report, the AR6, set to be released in June 2022. Have you heard anything about new developments in that?
Not of the sixth one, but I was a reviewer of one of the earlier ones, and I wrote quite a detailed report. They never replied to my report, and I assume to other ones. You write it, and it disappears into a big black hole. But I have a few things I'd like to convey to you regarding the IPCC. First, there is a principle that no committee has ever written a symphony. You get several hundred scientists, all of them competent scientists, written peer-reviewed papers. The IPCC cites these papers in some detail, and that's very excellent, fantastic. However, when it comes to the summary for policyholders, then there are a small group of people, the leaders, who summarize or rather draw the conclusions out of all this literature. Something happens there. It's a large, very large committee, and the conclusions are based on a lot of data. But the question is, are they the correct conclusion? Well, looking at it now for a number of years, a number of leading climate scientists, the ones who do not belong to the IPCC, but are the great, you can say, pioneers and thinkers and publishers in climate science, have published observations and conclusions which differ markedly from those of the IPCC. The main one, the most important one, when you look at the plots and trajectories and trends of IPCC projections, they are essentially smooth and linear. Then, if there is mitigation, they slow down and eventually start slowing down or going down. And this was the hope. Unfortunately, I don't think it's a real hope that the curve will go up slowly and then go down slowly again, and that humanity will have time to control the process. Well, unfortunately, it seems from, at least from my paleoclimate science studies, that nature does not behave like this. From certain points of warming, and the same is true for cooling, there are what you call amplifying feedbacks. Amplifying feedbacks, the most obvious one at the moment, at the present time, will be the release of methane. Methane has been in the atmosphere, has tripled. That's a major, major reinforcement or amplifying factor. So these smooth trends, they conceal the amplifying feedbacks, and they certainly don't even mention the studies resulting from the flow of cold ice melt water. So here's the first one. It's almost obvious, but the question is whether the sixth report will dwell on it or not. I don't know. They never even mentioned it in previous reports. They didn't mention amplifying feedbacks. They didn't mention studies. They didn't mention the rate at which the ice sheets are breaking. They already have been breaking for at least 20 years. It's based on studies of people who actually looked at the satellite data and even went to Greenland. they have been breaking very fast, and yet the IPCC has hardly mentioned it. Fires. We know all about fires. You know about fires. I know about fires. They have been, well, the role of fires has been minimized, I'd say. Some of the greatest climate scientists that we had, one of them is Wally Boker, an American scientist, is still alive in Lamont Doherty in Columbia University. He said something which is really a key statement. He says the paleoclimate record shows to us that far from being self-stabilizing, the Earth climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts even to small nudges. Now, here we go. These are the tipping points we're talking about. These are the extreme weather events we are looking at, whether it's the beast from the east going through the Arctic boundary, I should say, or whether it's the warm tropical forms which are also penetrating into the Arctic. You know about the fires in the Arctic, in Greenland and Scandinavia. These have been, to date, I hope they will correct it in the sixth report, either minimized or overlooked by the IPCC.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Earth and Paleoclimate Scientist Dr. Andrew Glickson from ANU in Australia. And we're talking about humanity's approach to the climate catastrophe. And you talked about leading climate scientists, and obviously the name of James Hansen is going to come up. Now, I know not all scientists agree with his work. For example, I interviewed Dr. Bjorn Stevens from the Max Planck Institute. He says cooling from aerosols is much lower than Hansen suggests, and the IPCC reports they estimate sea level rise much lower than Hansen does. So do you know James Hansen, and how much confidence do you have in his work?
James Hansen, to me, has made the few most important advances in climate and paleoclimate science over the last 30 years. But it's not just him. People quote one name. He is leading up a very large group of climate scientists and paleoclimate scientists, mostly in the United States, but not only. Now, I've read many of his publications, and being myself mostly a paleoclimate scientist, I was impressed by his insights and actually where his predictions have actually turned out to be correct. Yeah, people can say that he has underestimated or overestimated the aerosols, but he himself, in more than one paper, he says that the level at which aerosols affects the terrestrial climate is still to be known in much greater detail. He said it himself. Now, people like to criticize other people at the top. For example, look at the criticism in historical context which Einstein has received. Well, Einstein was a huge brain. He conceived relativity and special relativity the way which no committee would ever do. No committee such as the IPCC would ever arrive at some of the major conclusions which scientists, individual scientists, and sometimes small groups of scientists have reached. And as to the larger collective of scientists, sure, there will always be those who will be critical of one aspect or the other. But we need to look at the bigger picture. Hansen has already in 1980, 1990 perceived the major feature, major hallmarks of what we are looking at now, right now. People who read his papers will see that he has almost written, almost in some detail, what's happening in the Earth now in terms of warming, in terms of extreme weather events, and based on both present climate and paleoclimate.
So now we come to the point where the IPCC and all governments really have agreed that we need to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in order to get back to a stable climate where we can live. James Hansen also says we need to be below 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide, for example. What methods to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere would you favor?
Yes, they agree now that it has to be reduced. But most of the talk is about lower emissions, which, of course, is essential. It's essential to lower and even cut emissions as much as possible. Fewer scientists talk about carbon dioxide drawdown, and yet the amplifying feedbacks are getting stronger all the time. How do they reply or answer to this issue? Well, only a few of them do. There are now quite a bit of literature about CO2 drawdown sequestration, but not all scientists are acquainted with the effect of amplifying feedbacks. And in fact, climate science is very far from uniform. You have those climate scientists who observe present trends, current trends in the atmosphere and the oceans and the land. Then you get the paleoclimate scientists who look at atmospheric and ocean events in the past, in the near past, and the further away. But then you get a very large group of the computer modelers. This is where I have a problem. Computer modeling is, of course, because it's got to do with computer, which is a modern mod con, is something that people see as real science. But modeling is based on assumptions. And assumptions might or might not be correct. And the result, the product of computer modeling, we just talked about it. It's linear, totally unrealistic linear trends going all the way to the end of this century and even 2300. This is something that has, I think, confused the picture more than anything else. And that's a product of computers. They simply fed in the various factors, but what they didn't feed are the amplifying feedbacks, or they only fed it to a limited extent. They ignored the phenomenon of stadials, which was already shown to be at least since, the last 2015, but even before that. I have major problems with computer modeling.
And I noticed, too, a chapter on what you call space lunacy, but scientists depend on observations coming from satellites. Why are you railing about the sort of space madness that's developing now?
That's not so much to do with the climate, only indirectly. I mean, in a world which is suffering from serious climate disruption, to pour hundreds of billions and even trillions into exploration of other planets. This is lunacy. These are the funds which need to feed hungry children in Africa, if I can put it this way. But not less so, these are the funds required to attempt to sequester, attempt to draw down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is, as far as I can see, the only way to try and cool the climate. Reducing emissions is absolutely essential, but no longer sufficient. So for some billionaires who are not subject to really any democratic system or any electoral system to squander the remaining resources which we have on Earth on these space games is, I think it's criminal. Now, I have studied asteroids and I find the planets and space extremely interesting, in fact, even exciting. But to spend trillions on that, this is criminal because, as I say, it comes out of the mouths of hungry children. And I'm afraid I come out as a moralist or a humanist, but yeah, I'm unashamedly humanist. And I put the survival of not just humans, but nature itself, the animals, the birds, and so on, at the highest priority.
Well, the idea that we're going to escape from a crumbling Earth and just have colonies on Mars is pretty absurd and, as you say, damaging. Now, I want to get in here a quote that I found in your new book from James Hansen, and he said this: "We've reached a point where we have a crisis, an emergency, but people don't know that. There's a big gap between what's understood about global warming by the scientific community and what is known by the public and policymakers." Is that still true, or are people starting to get it?
To me, what James Hansen said is precisely what needs to be said. People now know in principle that there is a phenomenon of climate change, but not all that many realize how immediate, urgent, and serious it is. The ones who realize are the school children, it's Greta Thunberg and her followers, because they seem to have an open mind about it. But by and large, the media, as far as I can see, is dominated by vested interests. They have been denying climate change for, 20 or 30 years. Now they admit that something is going on, but they will try and minimize it. And, of course, as we know, the governments and the vested interests and the media are very closely connected.
Well, something we all need to find ways to cope with, sort of the uber knowledge of global warming coming at us like a freight train, and our daily needs to perhaps get in a car and go and get some food with a gas engine. So one of the ways that it seems to me that you're handling this, as you say in your book, is existential philosophy. Now, some of my listeners won't know what that is, but how does that help you cope?
Well, I'm in a position, unfortunate position, that a large, huge part in me doesn't want to scare other people, cloud other people's days. People around me, well, not everybody really wants to know. And I understand it perfectly. People want to live in the present or the near future. So that's one part of me that's a humanist in me, which doesn't want to depress other people, and I don't. The other part is the sense of duty of a scientist to report the evidence, report the facts. Because what are we doing science for if we are reluctant or refuse to report the evidence? I'm not saying that the evidence of which I'm aware is a whole or complete truth. Of course, we all make errors and mistakes. But I think the phenomenon of global climate disruption is now beyond doubt. It's moved well beyond doubt, and the people who have been throwing doubt have been shown to be, in part receiving funds from vested interests. So I'm in that conflict. I do report the evidence, but a large part of me says, well, Andrew, what's the point? And the other part says, well, perhaps the train already left the station and it's too late to do anything about it. Climate scientists are in this bind, but not all of them respond in the same way.
So your new book, The Event Horizon, Homo Prometheus and the Climate Catastrophe, it comes from the textbook publisher Springer. All their titles are pretty expensive. They're designed for professional audiences. Who do you think will benefit from this book, and where else can my listeners go to find some of your public writing?
Yeah, well, there are summaries of my book, and of course there's an awful lot, there's a mountain of literature on this very issue elsewhere, including in some part of the media. It's a question whether people want to read it, want to listen, and even if they do, whether they are able to do very much about it. I do admire the young, the school children, I do. If there is hope, it's these young children who might bring it about. But I am, of course, at a different stage of my life. And people say that climate scientists and so on are optimists or pessimists or whatever they are. It's inherent in science, and even when you do science for much or most of your life, that you try and go beyond your feelings, your emotions of being optimist or pessimist. I think many of us, certainly I, try and look directly at the evidence and draw our conclusions from it. As to how it affects our feelings, well, some of us get depressed. Of course I get depressed. But some of us decide, well, we just need to report it so that, at least for the benefit of future generations.
We've been speaking with Dr. Glickson, a climate scientist, geologist, asteroid tracker, deep time specialist. Find links to his new book and some recent articles you can look at for free and more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. It's always great talking with you.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for the interview and for your programs and for the information and evidence which you are disseminating. I hope and I'm sure it will have a very positive effect.
I'm Alex Smith. We are out of time, for this week's show at least. Despite raging disease and crumbling politics, you keep showing up. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Remember, you can listen to all past Radio EcoShock programs absolutely free at our website, ecoshock.org.